Welcome back to Future Thinkers. So this week we invited Nora Bateson back on the show for another sense-making conversation. We wanted to hear Nora's views on the current disintegration of societal systems and how to navigate the chaos of this world. Today we talk about how to raise and educate children for this uncertain future, how to find potential for healing and transformation in these difficult times, and she also shares some thought-provoking quotes with us from her father Gregory Bateson's writings. To see the full version of this interview, become a Future Thinkers member at futurethinkers.org/members. And to get all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/127. We've been working on something awesome for our members community, and we're very excited to show it to you guys. So a big announcement is coming in the next episode, so stay tuned.
We just finished a great meditation workshop with John Vervaeke, where he guided our members through finding their center, their root, their flow, and their focus. The recording of the workshop is now available in the members area. We have another workshop coming up too with a meditation teacher named Michael Taft. We've also had him on the show previously. This one's going to be about generating archetypal mind states, which is a really useful skill to have in times of global transition. To find out more and to sign up, go to futurethinkers.org/Taft, T-A-F-T. Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
But where are you? You're on the West Coast?
Yeah, we're in a small town called Kamloops, about 4 hours drive from Vancouver, BC.
We're in British Columbia. Kamloops, aha. You know that I used to live in Nelson.
Oh, really?
What? Really?
No, I didn't know that. Yeah.
For how long?
Quite a while. I lived there. I moved there right after 9/11. But the minute I heard George Bush say, we're going to root out those evildoers and get revenge, I was like, systems problem. This is going to take 50 years. I don't want to be around for this. This is going to be ugly, and it's not my thing. So, and I had little kids, and so I moved to Nelson with my husband. And there's quite a bit in this story, so we're recording, right? We might as well dive in. It was an incredible moment because we moved there. We started, you know, sort of building a life right there on the lake. And it's a cute little hippie town. You know, you've been there. And then we sort of got caught in immigration limbo. And we got caught there for a few years. And I can't say we were in a giant rush to sort it out, because limbo is kind of an interesting place to be in. In that moment, it was okay, because the stakes weren't as high as they are right now, and we were all together, and so we weren't in danger. But what we did have is the opportunity to pull our kids out of school. And I was really sensitive to them being in the States in that moment, because I don't know where you guys were in that moment, but every single conversation was deep soaked in a kind of cynicism that it was very heavy. And for little children, all they heard adults talk about was war. Every coffee date, every pickup at the kindergarten, everything was war. And so it was a lot. So anyway, we moved to Canada, and when we did that, we pulled them out of school. And I had always wanted to do that. My father pulled me out of school. And so then it was an opportunity, because, you know, you have to repeat your own childhood. Like, no matter, you might be noticing that right about now, no matter how hard you try to do it differently, there's things that just, like, they come through. So we did that, and we took them down to South America. And traveled with the children. They were, I think, 7 and 9 at that time. And I got to give them an education in systems.
Cool. When
they were really little. And so that whatever they built on from there, they would have that. And so I got to, you know, we didn't have any homeschool curriculum. We made up our own. And we did an hour of reading and chose some great books and an hour of writing. And we did some math together. And we traveled. And we all went to a Spanish class, intro to Spanish, with mommy, daddy, and the two kids all at the same level. And so we had when I talk about mutual learning across generations, that was the moment when we really were mutually, we were learning together, but really learning differently. There were things that each of us were, had aptitudes for and things that we didn't. But my kids got to see me learning at the same time that I was suddenly their teacher. And that was a really interesting relationship shifter. And I kind of had no idea at the time how profound it was. I wish I had actually, you know, done some recording of it, but I didn't. And then we tried to put them back in school, and they were 3 years ahead, 3 months later. We couldn't put them back in because they got so, I mean, we weren't supercharging them. I was not one of those parents who was like, I want my children to be little Einsteins. No, we were just actually bailing on the system, trying to get parallel, and accidentally got really ahead.
I'd imagine that would be a little scary too, to do, knowing that there are some ways within the system that they might fall behind. But I would imagine you would discover over time that that would actually be an asset to their resume when they go to look for jobs or do whatever they want within the system, because they suddenly stand out compared to everyone else.
Yeah. And, you know, like, look, just like, let's just look at that sentence that you just put together and how complex that is, because you guys are parents now, and you might have thought that you were going to interview me tonight, but I had my own plan here. how do we do this, right? As parents, we're talking about systems change. This is such an important nut. The thing is in the intergenerational expectations, the communications, the dreaming, the visioning, the tiny signaling that goes on, right? So how do you prepare your children to not fail in the existing system, but to be able to create a new system and to not have any attachment to the existing system because it's shifting under their feet? Mm-hmm. Yours is very small right now. Mine are, I mean, I've got one, you know, marching the streets of San Francisco, and one here saying, what am I supposed to do now? So, and then lots of other ones in between thinking, you know, they're Swedish, so they have a different set of sensibilities around this. But, you know, there's a lot in that question you just asked about, am I afraid that they won't have a place in the criteria that the systems of the existing institutions will evaluate them on? Do I protect them from being evaluated in ways that will shut them out, isolate them? Or do I, just as I was saying, just get parallel? It's a big question. So, but the thing is, this is that I had been taken out of school. My dad took me out of school. He got diagnosed with lung cancer when I was, I think, about 9. And they only gave him a few weeks or months to live. And as it turned out, he lived 3 more years. And during that time, I was sent to school in this school in the Big Sur coastline. And the ride there was like, teeny tiny windy little roads on a bus for an hour every day. And, you know, my dad was dying. And anyway, I would go to school and just vomit. And so whether it was emotional or physical or both, or, and plus the way they were teaching me that the world was put together was in complete opposition to the way that I was learning at home, that the world was put together. So there was this schism, and I preferred one version much over the other. And so my dad was like, forget it, let's just don't send her. And so we did whatever. It wasn't homeschooling then, because it wasn't a thing. There was no thing about that. So somehow we got permission. I don't really know how we did it, but he didn't have a curriculum for me. I wrote little papers for him about, like, you know, how to think in base 5 when I was 10. And, you know, he asked me questions, and there were things I didn't know I wasn't supposed to know. And we, you know, played with ideas, and we wrote poetry, and, you know, got up in the middle of the night and studied the stars, and we traveled, and I went to all of his seminars, and, you know, a couple of years went by. And then after he died, I went back into school and they tested me. And, you know, to your point, my spelling was like absolute crap. But my math skills were off the charts. My comprehension skills were super high. My capacity for repeating information was very low. My capacity for generating and connecting things was super high. So if they had actually just put me as a freshman in university at the age of whatever I was then, 13, it would have been much better. But they didn't. They put me in seventh grade or eighth grade. Was it eighth grade? And the nightmare was some kind of like horror story that it was just awful. And I never got above a C in math again. Loss, huge loss. So, but I had the model, it was in there. So then when I had my own kids, I knew that I had gotten so much out of that and that it was possible. That's the big thing, is that it's possible, because that fear that you're talking about there was definitely mitigated by having been through it myself and seen my father do it. And he wasn't anxious about it. He wasn't thinking, oh, I hope she doesn't lose. I hope she doesn't fall behind. But, you know, there was none of that. And there was also, he never said, this is so interesting, he never said one word to me about my future. He never said, when you grow up and get married, or when you go to college, or when you, not one word. And I didn't realize that until I was an adult. And then I suddenly realized that he had never said one thing about what he envisioned for my future. And what a profound gift that is.
Yeah, he let you choose your own.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like, you know how careful you have to be to not fall into those scripts around what university you go to, or what partnership you have, or, you know, and that whole projection of, oh, aren't you getting big? And, you know, the whole thing around what do you want to be when you grow up is an epistemological, some sort of weird epistemological future scripting that invites you to see yourself in the system that's existing now, but not to think, not to be generative of just what are the pathways that are right here in front of you that you're tending. And so for me, especially in this moment, that's really important, that we don't go future skipping into some idea of what a future society could look like, because our ideas are totally contaminated by the system that we're in. And the only thing that's going to make those future possibilities possible is the tending the very minute relationships of the moment. Anyway, I think it's really interesting. And I wanted to ask you, how is parenthood going?
Really fun.
Yeah, it's good.
It's awesome.
He's like a new baby every week or two. He's changing so fast. It's really cool to see him developing and, you know, becoming more aware and developing a personality.
I find myself getting used to the way he is, and then in the back of my mind thinking, he's always going to be like this. This is the new him. It's all the same. And then the next day he's different. Then the next day he's different. So it's like I'm always surprised every day and kind of looking forward to what's next. It's really fun.
Yeah.
And you have to be different with him every day.
Yeah.
And certainly every couple weeks you have to, you know, provide different kinds of food, different kinds of play, different kinds of communication, different kinds of ways of holding, moving, in bodily interactions, clothing, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. I just think it's such a beautiful example of what it is to actually be in mutually responsive, complex systems. And, you know, it sounds so abstract when you put it like that. And people are like, but what are you talking about? We have to have a strategy. We have to have control. We have to know what's going to happen. And it's like, you know, actually, you don't. And we never have. And anyone who's ever had a child has had to do that, whether they were conscious of it or not.
You know, that's one of the first times that's ever really occurred to me, is that before becoming a parent, I would have expected strategy to play a much bigger role in this. Like, how do I kind of shape this kid or expose him to the right things or just be strategic with him and exposure to the world? And there's none of that. There's none of it at all. It's all just complete in the present attunement with what he wants and what he's doing and what he's interested in and nothing else. So that's been surprising.
Yeah, go ahead. Make a plan.
Yeah.
You could also sleep in that 10 minutes. Much more productive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how this is kind of a meta thing for what's happening in the world. The world is changing and we have to respond differently in every moment. And you said something on Twitter that really, really resonated with me. Something along the lines of, you know, trying to strategize and create some sort of big plans for the future is the last thing we should be doing right now. We should be tuning into what's emerging and being present. And it's funny how ingrained that is into us, that we have to project something into the future, that we have to plan, that we have to have this rigid thing, you know, ABC, 1, 2, 3 steps to getting there.
That everything will fall apart if I take my hand off the wheel.
Yeah.
That's a big one for me. And for watching people at conferences interact, like there's this idea that we have to plan the future. We have to direct everything and that it will fall apart if we don't. And I feel like just looking at my own life, that's when things have worked out the worst. It's when I'm like involved at every step, grinding.
Force things.
And when I just step back for a second, that, you know, let things move, then things have worked out like beyond my expectations.
Yeah. And I mean, what I'm seeing right now is that we are in a intersystemic, transcontextual transformation. We're in the beginning of it. And it's already getting very confusing. And it's going to get more confusing because we're literally disintegrating. Our systems are disintegrating. And so our whole identity and understanding of who we are and how we interact and who we are in relationship to each other and what my status is or what my relevance is to life, you know, to my community, all that stuff is shifting because it's all existing in relationship to an existing set of structures. And those structures are turning to sand. And, you know, there's some very frightening undercurrents in that of authoritarian control and, you know, high tech control and militaristic, all sorts of stuff. But even that right now, I'm kind of like, well, it's a little bit like being a parent, like good luck trying to get control of this. Because like you said, Yvie, this is the time of the unraveling. And it doesn't seem like a good moment to be trying to put down foundations for a new structure of a new societal process. What it does seem like a really good time to do is to actually think about and pay attention to how we are in relationship. How much breadth and breath is there in the relationships that we're in that they can change, that there can be learning, that there can't, we can be in transformation together. What is that actually asking of me? And it's been interesting because there's been a lot of kind of mimetic discussion around uncertainty. And it's interesting because uncertainty, of course, if you're dealing with the complex system that's changing, you don't know what's happening, there's uncertainty. But that's kind of an interesting word because it's a noun, it's a state. And it implies that there's something even still in the uncertainty state. So we have to learn to be in uncertainty is a really interesting kind of set of twisted approaches. If someone said you have to be in the water, be in the fluidity of the water, like what is that really? That's a lot of movement, right? In actual time, being in the fluidity of water is not like, and now I'm being, and there is fluidity, right? You have to be in relationship. You have to be engaged in that.
Participatory.
It's participatory. And so somehow I think this came up recently that if you add time to that uncertainty, what you're going to end up with is spontaneity. That there's this need to be able to respond in ways that are both somehow eternal and immediate. So you can't really plan, but at the same time, you know that if you put seeds in the ground now, you have to wait. And those seeds are going to grow to become something that becomes something that gives, you know, that will someday be at your table at a dinner that you might serve to someone where a really interesting conversation happens, right? So there's something about being in the eternal with spontaneity.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses. Get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
If you're using the metaphor of the garden, it's interesting because, so we planted a garden this year and planted a lot of different things, really a big variety. And some of the things came up really strong and some of the things just never came up at all. And I think that it's the same in this moment where, yeah, we can plant a lot of seeds, but we simply don't know what's going to come up.
Yeah. Yeah, we simply don't know what the soil is best for, what is being beckoned from the future.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
From the past and pulled from the future. I don't know.
I feel like there's this like this atmosphere of urgency in everything nowadays. And that even knowing internally that I have to slow down and observe more, there's always that question of, okay, yeah, but when do I take action? And okay, yeah, but when do I do the thing? When do I actually affect or change or participate? And I've paid attention to this question for a long time, and I feel like I'm kind of fitting into my own rhythm with it, but I'm noticing in conversation with others, this is happening all the time. There's that urgency combined with like, okay, how the hell do I sit still and do nothing or observe if I'm not affecting anything? Like when there's emergency. And what I've come to is that there's an ability to kind of do both. Like there is action without being tied to the result of that action. There's just kind of inflow, kind of responding to the environment, but also having a bit of a plan and acting on it. But to me, the big difference is not being attached to the end result, not needing it to be the thing. So like in your garden metaphor, it's like plant the seeds, take that action and plan out the seeds in the garden the way you would want or the way that makes sense, but don't expect everything to come up.
And also responding to what does come up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that kind of helps me illustrate this. I think we're expecting for the plan to create everything we've planted in the garden, to have a step-by-step recipe for everything up until it reaches the plate. And that's causing existential crisis for a lot of people who are expecting that planning mentality to work out every time.
If your success as a gardener is based on the fact that all your plants grew, then you might actually decide that you're not a good gardener and you don't want to do that anymore. As opposed to you're an experimenter and you're going to keep trying different things and learning from different people and exploring your own relationship with the soil, which is also changing, in a climate, which is also changing, right? So there's nowhere to really hold on except that there is. I mean, there is that sense that there is, in fact, a deep interdependent process of life itself. And I want to talk a little bit, because it would be crazy for us not to mention that you know, there's the protests that are taking place right now, and how important this moment is to be recognized as a call for systems change, and that the systems change request is always befuddling to the system. The system never understands the system change request, right? So is this about incarcerating the police that were violent? Not really. It's about deep relational processes that have been in play for 400 years in the U.S., but you know, in other forms in a lot of places. So I guess there's something around that question that I was just asking you: how do we be in this together? How do we be in relationship through systems change that is supportive of something deeper than that which has been projected on us and we've been living in for the last patterns of intergenerational behavior, that this brings us right back to where we started. What is your relationship with your kids? What is being fabriced and tissued into that relationship that is going to be part of those relationships that our children are in new ways? And I was in a session around story and narrative the other day, and just kind of, it's so important to be able to say right now that the stories that we have grown up in are not the same, right? So I live in Sweden, but the stories that are here are not my stories. This is a country where people actually trust the government, right? This is the most foreign concept to me. And the way that it comes out is all these different things. You know, the response to the pandemic, the way that we think about immigration, the whole like relationship to doctors or teachers or authority, it comes out all over the place. How you feel about paying your way on the public transportation, like the little things are imbued with this deeper trust in the government. I don't have one cell in my body that knows that experience. And if I don't have it, imagine what it's like in the African American community. So the whole idea of what the patterns are that we're living in, and what the relevances are, and what the resiliences are, we're in systems change. And it's going to be really confusing, because for a lot of people, those stories around those heroes who built their country or their culture, those stories are real. My mom is 91 years old, and she's like, "But Nora, they're going to destroy the democracy." And I'm like, "But Mom, it was always an illusion." So how do you destroy something that was never there? What's happening? And I don't know. I think we need to bring it up. We need to be able to talk about this a little. And I know that it's always a little bit dangerous. But like you said, it's dangerous not to. So, you know, how to live in a different world. It's system change through all the systems, right? So what happened with the health system and the pandemic? It got revealed to be, it's still coming out, right? The pharmaceuticals have been doing bogus research, and the WHO didn't communicate, and China, blah, blah, blah. And then the memes and the internet and the governments and the go back to work. And are we going back to work because we'll die if we don't? Or are we going back to work because they'll die if we don't? So there's this quote I posted on my Facebook, a really hard quote. I think Yuvi saw it. It's hard. I don't often post stuff by my dad that's this hard, because I we could get accused of being abstract. But there's this part in his book, Mind and Nature, where there's a metalogue, a conversation with a father-daughter. And those are all, by the way, those are all fictional. But they are also very much like the conversations in the house. So I don't know if you've seen those, but they're in his books. And people think that those conversations are the easiest part of the books to read. And my advice is, no, they're not. They're probably the hardest, because everything that gets said, kind of in the in-between. But they're talking about eternal verities. And I've used the word eternal a couple of times here today. And it's a question of like, what are those things that are the deep truths, that are the eternal truths? And of course, there's all sorts of paradoxes in that, because you know, if you say that there aren't any eternal verities, then that becomes an eternal verity. And anyway, you can get really tangled up in that thing. But he's talking about, can I read you the quote?
Yeah.
I'll send it to you in so that you have it. And he, the daughter's like, okay, but what is, let me find out where this is. The daughter says, they're talking about tautology too. So tautology is an interesting word, and it's a tricky one to get to know because it kind of folds in on itself. How would you explain tautology if somebody didn't understand the word tautology?
I actually don't know what it means.
Okay. All right. That makes it good. That means that we have to get really real here. It's an important word right now. All right. So the definition that he gives is that a tautology is an aggregate of linked propositions in which the validity of the links between them cannot be doubted. So it's like when you get into, oh, I'm a filmmaker, so this is an easy one. So if I'm making a film that takes place on a planet where everything's blue, then everything being blue is part of the linked logic of the planet, right? And I don't have to explain that, why that's happening. But what I do have to do is be consistent as a filmmaker to stay to the logic of that particular process, of that world that I've created, that there's a blue world. So it's a tautology is when you get lots of inputs that, but the thing is they don't have to be true. They just have to convince each other that they're true.
Just internally consistent, but when you take it from, when you look at it from outside of the system, it doesn't have to be consistent with the
that's
outside.
Right. That's right. That's actually pretty good, Yubi. That's pretty much what it is. So there, it's tricky because you can create all kinds of tautologies, like that children have to get good grades and go to university, right? And we can all believe into that. Or like capitalism, there's a tautology. Money. So you can begin to, you know, generate ideas that become consistent within a particular set of ideas. But if you get into a different set of ideas, those ideas aren't consistent at all. So the daughter's saying, you know, how do you keep this question of what's eternal from becoming a tautology? Because what you see as eternal, you're going to see as eternal, right? And what if the things you see aren't the things that are eternal? How would you know? Because those are the things that you see as eternal. So it's a tricky one. And I recognize that it could be sounding very, I don't know, academic, or that we're getting, you know, into jargon here, but I actually want to ground this because it's vital to be able to look at this right now in the midst of systems change, in the midst of all these processes coming unwound. This is the kind of stuff we have to be looking at, of like, what are the consistencies across these different systems that we're in that become laced into, steeped into the tiniest details of how you raise your kids.
They're kind of like self-fulfilling prophecies. Like, we think something is true and we act as if it's true and we build systems as if it's true and it becomes true because it then affects us in return. But it may not necessarily be true if we just stop doing it.
Yeah. And the just stop doing it part is really an interesting piece right now, because we just had this pandemic moment when everybody just stopped doing stuff. And what I think has begun to happen through that pandemic is that some of the consistency of the tautology we've been in, of the set of assumptions that we've been in, has lost its muchness. some stuff that was accepted as just what is stopped being is, and or got revealed in ways that for some people there was a strength and a robustness to a system that wasn't stoppable, that was actually completely stoppable and totally broken. And actually, you know, the bailouts to the airlines are much bigger than the bailouts to the single mothers on welfare. So who is the taker? Who's the leech on society? Right? Anyway, there are tautological issues. So he says this, and I'll send this to you because you'll probably want to put it up because it's heavy language. Is this okay that we're doing this?
No, this is great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So the daughter says, so they're talking about eternal verities. She says, but how can you know if it's all tautological? And the father says, no, of course not. But if the question is once asked, I can't avoid having an opinion. Okay, because we're in the tautologies. Well, the daughter says, is it? The father says, is it what? And the daughter says, tautological. You see, this is how tautologies work. And then father says, and this is the bit I wanted to bring in. All right. My opinion is that the creatura, the world of mental process. Now, in Bateson speak, the world of mental process is not necessarily that which is happening in academia or in the mind. The world of mental process is that which is alive. That mental process is part of the sort of notions of mind being the incredible responsiveness that creates vitality. That's a quick summation. But in all those relationships that make life. Okay. In the world of mental process is both tautological and ecological. Okay. So it's both of those things. I mean that it's a slowly self-healing tautology. Left to itself, any large piece of creatura will tend to settle toward tautology. That is, toward internal consistency of ideas and processes. Internal consistency of ideas and processes. But every now and then, the consistency gets torn. The tautology breaks up like the surface of a pond when a stone is thrown into it. Then the tautology slowly but immediately starts to heal. Interesting word. And the healing may be ruthless. Whole species may be exterminated in the process. So I think that's a really important thing to be considering, and I'll say why. Because I know that my father's language is difficult at best. There's a tear in the consistencies of the internal tautology processes, of the internal logics, the internal linking processes that we have been within. They are tearing. And as they're tearing because there's some bigger interdependency. There's a bigger aspect of life. That which the ecology with which we have been living, let's call it an ecology of institutions. They're interdependent. They're in patterned relationships. In many ways, they function much like a forest, except for one itty bitty little detail, which is that in order to make those institutional ecologies work, is destroying. They're exploiting human beings, relationships, other forms of interdependencies of life. So it's like a vampire that's just eating relational vitality. So there's a healing, right? There's this bigger interdependency, these bigger processes.
All right, we're going to stop here. And if you want to hear and see the full interview, become a member at futurethinkers.org/members. To check out the show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/127. And to listen to our previous interview with Nora, go to futurethinkers.org/106. We'll see you in the next episode.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.